The great admiral's cabin at the stern had been hastily converted into something of a state apartment for Prince Yongxing, and the captain's cabin beneath the poop deck divided for the other two senior envoys, the smaller quarters nearby given over to the crowd of guards and attendants, displacing not only Riley himself but also the ship's first lieutenant, Lord Purbeck, the surgeon, the master, and several other of his officers. Fortunately, the quarters at the fore of the ship, ordinarily reserved for the senior aviators, were all but empty, with Temeraire the only dragon aboard. Even shared out among them all, there was no shortage of room, and for the occasion the ship's carpenters had knocked down the bulkheads of their individual cabins and made a grand dining space. Too grand at first. Hammond had objected. "We cannot seem to have more room than the prince," he explained, and so had the bulkheads shifted a good 6 feet forward. The collected tables were suddenly cramped. Riley had benefited from the enormous prize money awarded for the capture of Temeraire's egg almost as much as Lawrence himself had. Fortunately, he could afford to keep a good table and a large one. The occasion indeed called for every stick of furniture which could be found on board. The instant he had recovered from the appalling shock of having his invitation even partly accepted, Riley had invited all the senior members of the gunroom, Lawrence's own lieutenants, and any other man who might reasonably be expected to make civilized conversation. "But Prince Yongxing is not coming," Hammond said, "and the rest of them have less than a dozen words of English between them, except for the translator, and he is only one man." "Then at least we can make enough noise amongst ourselves. We will not all be sitting in grim silence," Riley said. But this hope was not answered. The moment the guests arrived, a paralyzed silence descended, bidding fair to continue throughout the meal. Though the translator had accompanied them, none of the Chinese spoke at first. The older envoy, Liu Bao, had stayed away also, leaving Sun Kai as the senior representative, but even he made only a spare, formal greeting on their arrival, and afterwards maintained a calm and silent dignity, though he stared intently at the barrel-thick column of the foremast, painted in yellow stripes, which came down through the ceiling and passed directly through the middle of the table, and went so far as to look beneath the tablecloth to see it continuing down through the deck below. Riley had left the right side of the table entirely for the Chinese guests, and had them shown to places there, but they did not move to sit, when he and the officers did, which left the British in confusion, some men already half-seated and trying to keep themselves suspended in mid-air. Bewildered, Riley pressed them to take their seats, but he had to urge them several times before at last they would sit. It was an inauspicious beginning, and did not encourage conversation. The officers began by taking refuge in their dinners, but even that semblance of good manners did not last very long. The Chinese did not eat with knife and fork, but with lacquered sticks they had brought with them. These they somehow manoeuvred one-handed to bring food to their lips, and shortly the British half of the company were staring in helplessly rude fascination, every new dish presenting a fresh opportunity to observe the technique. The guests were briefly puzzled by the platter of roast mutton, large slices carved from the leg, but after a moment one of the younger attendants carefully proceeded to roll up a slice, still only using the sticks, and pick it up entire to eat in 3 bites, leading the way for the rest. By now Trip, Riley's youngest midshipman, a plump and unlovely 12-year-old aboard by virtue of his family's 3 votes in Parliament, and invited for his own education rather than his company, was surreptitiously trying to imitate the style, using his fork and knife turned upside down in place of the sticks, his efforts meeting without notable success except in doing damage to his formerly clean breeches. He was too far down the table to be quelled by hard looks, and the men around him were too busy gawking themselves to notice. Sun Kai had the seat of honour nearest Riley, and desperate to keep his attention from the boy's antics, Riley tentatively raised a glass to him, watching Hammond out of the corner of his eye for direction, and said, "To your health, sir." Hammond murmured a hasty translation across the table, and Sun Kai nodded, raised his own glass, and sipped politely, though not very much. It was a heady Madeira, well fortified with brandy, chosen to survive rough seas. For a moment it seemed this might rescue the occasion. The rest of the officers were belatedly recalled to their duty as gentlemen, and began to salute the rest of the guests. The pantomime of raised glasses was perfectly comprehensible without any translation, and led naturally to a thawing of relations. Smiles and nods began to traverse the table, and Lawrence heard Hammond, beside him, heave out an almost inaudible sigh through open lips and finally take some little food. Lawrence knew he was not doing his own part, but his knee was lodged up against the trestle of the table, preventing him from stretching out his now aching leg, and though he had drunk as sparingly as was polite, his head felt thick and clouded. By this point he only hoped he might avoid embarrassment, and resigned himself to making apologies to Riley after the meal for his dullness. Riley's third lieutenant, a fellow named Franks, had spent the first three toasts in rude silence, sitting woodenly and raising his glass only with a mute smile, but sufficient flow of wine loosened his tongue at last. He had served on an East Indiaman as a boy during the peace, and evidently had acquired a few stumbling words of Chinese. Now he tried the less obscene of them on the gentleman sitting across from him, a young, clean-shaven man named Ye Bing, gangly beneath the camouflage of his fine robes, who brightened and proceeded to respond with his own handful of English.
Very fine,
he said, and stuck, unable to find the rest of the compliment he wished to make, shaking his head as Franks offered, alternatively, the options which seemed to him most natural: wind, night, and dinner. At last, Ye Bing beckoned over the translator, who said on his behalf, "Many compliments to your ship. It is most cleverly devised." Such praise was an easy way to a sailor's heart. Riley, overhearing, broke off from his disjointed bilingual conversation with Hammond and Sun Kai on their likely southward course, and called down to the translator, "Pray thank the gentleman for his kind words, sir, and tell him that I hope you will all find yourselves quite comfortable." Ye Bing bowed his head and said, through the translator, "Thank you, sir. We are already much more so than on our journey here. Four ships were required to carry us here, and one proved unhappily slow." "Captain Riley, I understand you have gone round the Cape of Good Hope before," Hammond interrupted, rudely, and Lawrence glanced at him in surprise. Riley also looked startled, but politely turned back to answer him, but Franks, who had spent nearly all of the last 2 days below in the stinking hold, directing the stowage of all the baggage, said in slightly drunken irreverence,
"Four ships only? I'm surprised it did not take six. It must have been packed like sardines."
Ye Bing nodded and said, "The vessels were small for so long a journey, but in the service of the Emperor all discomfort is a joy, and in any case they were the largest of your ships in Canton at the time."
"Oh, so you hired East Indiamen for the passage?"
MacReady asked. He was the marine lieutenant, a real thin, wiry stump of a man who wore spectacles incongruous on his much-scarred face. There was no malice, but undeniably a slight edge of superiority in the question, and in the smiles exchanged by the naval men. That the French could build ships but not sail them, that the Dons were excitable and undisciplined, that the Chinese had no fleet at all to speak of, these were the oft-repeated bywords of the service. And to have them so confirmed was always pleasant, always heartening.
"Four ships in Canton Harbour, and you filled their holds with baggage instead of silk and porcelain? They must have charged you the earth," Franks added.
"How very strange that you should say so," Ye Bing said. "Although we were travelling under the Emperor's seal, it is true, one captain did try to demand payment, and then even try to sail away without permission. Some evil spirit must have seized hold of him and made him act in such a crazy manner. But I believe your company officials were able to find a doctor to treat him, and he was allowed to apologize."
Franks stared, as well he might.
"But then, why did they take you if you did not pay them?"
Ye Bing stared back, equally surprised to have been asked.
"Their ships were confiscated by imperial edict. What else could they have done?"
He shrugged as if to dismiss the subject and turned his attention back to the dishes. He seemed to think the piece of intelligence less significant than the small jam tartlets Riley's cook had provided with the latest course. Lawrence abruptly put down knife and fork. His appetite had been weak to begin with and now was wholly gone. That they could speak so casually of the seizure of British ships and property, the forced servitude of British seamen to a foreign throne. For a moment, almost, he convinced himself he had misunderstood. Every newspaper in the country would have been shrieking of such an incident. Government would surely have made a formal protest. Then he looked at Hammond. The diplomat's face was pale and alarmed, but unsurprised, and all remaining doubt vanished as Lawrence recalled all of Barham's sorry behaviour, so nearly grovelling, and Hammond's attempts to change the course of the conversation. Comprehension was only a little slower in coming to the rest of the British, running up and down the table on the backs of low whispers as the officers murmured back and forth to one another. Riley's reply to Hammond, which had been going forward all this time, slowed and stopped, though Hammond prompted Riley again, urgently, asking, "Did you have a rough crossing of it? I hope we do not need to fear bad weather along the way." This came too late. A complete silence fell, except for young Tripp chewing noisily. Garnet, the master, elbowed the boy sharply, and even this sound failed. Sun Kai put down his wine glass and looked frowning up and down along the table. He had noticed the change of atmosphere, the feel of a brewing storm. There had already been a great deal of hard drinking, though they were scarcely halfway through the meal, and many of the officers were young and flushing now with mortification and anger. Many a navy man cast on shore during an intermittent peace or by a lack of influence had served aboard the ships of the East India Company. The ties between Britain's navy and her merchant marine were strong, and the insult all the more keenly felt. The translator was standing back from the chairs with an anxious expression that most of the other Chinese attendants had not yet perceived. One laughed aloud at some remark of his neighbour's. It made a queer, solitary noise in the cabin.
"By God!" Franks said suddenly out loud. "I have a mind to—"
His seatmates caught him by the arms, hurriedly, and kept him in his chair, hushing him with many anxious looks up towards the senior officers, but others' whispers grew louder. One man was saying,
"Sitting at our table!"
to snatches of violent agreement. An explosion might come at any moment, certainly disastrous. Hammond was trying to speak, but no one was attending to him.
"Captain Riley,"
Lawrence said, harshly and overloud, quelling the furious whispers.
"Will you be so good as to lay out our course for the journey? I believe Mr. Granby was curious as to the route we would follow."
Granby, sitting a few chairs down, his face pale under his sunburn, started. Then, after a moment, he said,
"Yes, indeed, I would take it as a great favour, sir,"
nodding to Riley. "Of course," Riley said, if a little woodenly. He leaned over to the locker behind him, where his maps lay. Bringing one onto the table, he traced the course, speaking somewhat more loudly than normal.
"Once out of the channel, we must swing a ways out to skirt France and Spain. Then we will come in a little closer and keep to the coastline of Africa as best we can. We will put in at the Cape until the summer monsoon begins, perhaps a week or three, depending on our speed, and then ride the wind all the way to the South China Sea."
The worst of the grim silence was broken, and slowly a thin, obligatory conversation began again. But no one now said a word to the Chinese guests, except occasionally Hammond speaking to Sun Kai, and under the weight of disapproving stares even he faltered and was silent. Riley resorted to calling for the pudding, and the dinner wandered to a disastrous close far earlier than usual. There were marines and seamen standing behind every sea officer's chair to act as servants, already muttering to each other. By the time Lawrence regained the deck, pulling himself up the ladder way more by the strength of his arms than by properly climbing, they had gone out, and the news had gone from one end of the deck to another, the aviators even speaking across the line with the sailors. Hammond came out onto the deck and stared at the taut, muttering groups of men, biting his lips to bloodlessness. The anxiety made his face look queerly old and drawn. Lawrence felt no pity for him, only indignation. There was no question that Hammond had deliberately tried to conceal the shameful matter. Riley was beside him, not drinking the cup of coffee in his hand, boiled, if not burnt, by the smell of it. "Mr. Hammond," he said, very quiet, but with authority. More authority than Lawrence, who for most of their acquaintance had known him as a subordinate, had ever heard him use. An authority which quite cleared away all traces of his ordinary, easy-going humour. "Pray convey to the Chinamen that it is essential they stay below. I do not give a damn what excuse you like to give them, but I would not wager tuppence for their lives if they came on this deck now. Captain," he added, turning to Lawrence, "I beg you send your men to sleep at once. I don't like the mood."
"Yes,"
Lawrence said, in full understanding. Men so stirred could become violent, and from there it was a short step to mutiny. The original cause of their rage would not even necessarily matter by then. He beckoned Granby over. John, send the fellows below and have a word with the officers to keep them quiet. We want no disturbance. Granby nodded.
By God, though, he said,
hard-eyed with his own anger. But he stopped when Lawrence shook his head and went. The aviators broke up and went below quietly. The example might have been of some good, for the sailors did not grow quarrelsome when ordered to do the same. Then, also, they knew very well that their officers were in this case not their enemies. Anger was a living thing in every breast. Shared sentiment bound them all together, and little more than mutters followed when Lord Purbeck, the first lieutenant, walked out upon the deck among them and ordered them below in his drawling, affected accent.
"Go along now, Jenkins. Go along, Harvey."
Temeraire was waiting on the Dragon deck, with head raised high and eyes bright. He had overheard enough to be on fire with curiosity. Having had the rest of the story, he snorted and said,
"If their own ships could not have carried them, they had much better have stayed home."
This was less indignation at the offence than simple dislike, however, and he was not inclined to great resentment. Like most dragons, he had a very casual view of property, saving, of course, jewels and gold belonging to himself. Even as he spoke, he was busy polishing the great sapphire pendant which Lawrence had given him, and which he never removed save for that purpose.
"It is an insult to the crown," Lawrence said,
rubbing his hand over his leg with short, pummeling strokes, resentful of the injury. He wanted badly to pace. Hammond was standing at the quarter-deck rail smoking a cigar, the dim red light of the burning embers flaring with his inhalations, illuminating his pale and sweat-washed face. Lawrence glared at him along the length of the near-empty deck, bitterly.
"I wonder at him. At him and at Barham, to have swallowed such an outrage, with so little noise. It is scarcely to be borne."
Temeraire blinked at him.
"But I thought we must at all costs avoid war with China," he said, very reasonably, as he had been lectured on the subject without end for weeks, and even by Lawrence himself.
"I should rather settle with Bonaparte if the lesser evil had to be chosen," Lawrence said,
for the moment too angry to consider the question rationally.
"At least he had the decency to declare war before seizing our citizens, instead of this cavalier off-hand flinging of insults in our face, as if we did not dare to answer them. Not that government have given them any reason to think otherwise. Like a pack of damned curs rolling over to show their bellies. And to think," he added, smouldering, "that scoundrel was trying to persuade me to kowtow, knowing it should be coming after this."
Temeraire gave a snort of surprise at his vehemence, and nudged him gently with his nose.
"Pray do not be so angry. It cannot be good for you."
Lawrence shook his head, not in disagreement, and fell silent, leaning against Temeraire. It could do no good to vent his fury so, where some of the men left on deck might yet overhear and take it as encouragement to some rash act, and he did not want to distress Temeraire. But much was suddenly made plain to him. After swallowing such an insult, of course government would hardly strain at handing over a single dragon. The entire ministry would likely be glad to rid themselves of so unpleasant a reminder, and to see the whole business hushed up all the more thoroughly. He stroked Temeraire's side for comfort.
"Will you stay above decks with me a while?"
Temeraire asked him, coaxing.
"You had much better sit down and rest, and not fret yourself so."
Indeed, Lawrence did not want to leave him. It was curious how he could feel his lost calm restore itself under the influence of that steady heartbeat beneath his fingers. The wind was not too high at the moment, and not all of the night watch could be sent below. An extra officer on the deck would not be amiss.
"Yes, I will stay. In any case, I do not like to leave Riley alone with such a mood over the ship,"
he answered, and went limping for his wraps.
Chapter 4. The wind was freshening from the northeast, very cold. Lawrence stirred out of his half-sleep and looked up at the stars. Only a few hours had passed. He huddled deeper into his blankets by Temeraire's side and tried to ignore the steady ache in his leg. The deck was strangely quiet. Under Riley's grim and watchful eye there was scarcely any conversation at all among the remaining crew, though occasionally Lawrence could hear indistinct murmurs from the rigging above, men whispering to each other. There was no moon, only a handful of lanterns on deck.
"You are cold?" Temeraire said unexpectedly.
and Lawrence turned to see the great, deep blue eyes studying him.
"Go inside, Lawrence. You must get well, and I will not let anyone hurt Riley. Or the Chinese, I suppose, if you would not like it," he added, though without much enthusiasm.
Lawrence nodded tiredly and heaved himself up again. The threat of danger was over, he thought, at least for the moment, and there was no real sense in his staying above.
"You are comfortable enough?"
"Yes. With the heat from below I am perfectly warm," Temeraire said.
Indeed, Lawrence could feel the warmth of the dragon deck even through the soles of his boots. It was a great deal more pleasant in out of the wind. His legs stabbed unpleasantly twice as he climbed down to the upper berth deck, but his arms were up to his weight and held him until the spasm passed. He managed to reach his cabin without falling. Lawrence had several pleasant, small, round windows, not draughty, and near the ship's galley as he was, the cabin was still warm despite the wind. One of the runners had lit the hanging lantern, and Gibbon's book was still lying open on the lockers. He slept almost at once, despite the pain. The easy sway of his hanging cot was more familiar than any bed, and the low susurration of the water along the sides of the ship a wordless and constant reassurance. He came awake all at once, breath jolted out of his body before his eyes even quite opened. Noise more felt than heard. The deck abruptly slanted, and he flung out a hand to keep from striking the ceiling. A rat went sliding across the floor and fetched up against the four lockers before scuttling into the dark again, indignant. The ship righted almost at once. There was no unusual wind, no heavy swell. At once he understood that Temeraire had taken flight. Lawrence flung on his boat cloak and rushed out in nightshirt and bare feet. The drummer was beating to quarters, the crisp flying staccato echoing off the wooden walls, and even as Lawrence staggered out of his room, the carpenter and his mates were rushing past him to clear away the bulkheads. Another crash came. Bombs, he now recognised, and then Granby was suddenly at his side, a little less disordered since he had been sleeping in breeches. Lawrence accepted his arm without hesitation, and with his help managed to push through the crowd and get back up to the dragon deck through the confusion. Sailors were running with frantic haste to the pumps, flinging buckets out over the sides for water to slop onto the decks and wet down the sails. A bloom of orange-yellow was trying to grow on the edge of the furled mizzen topsail. One of the midshipmen, a spotty boy of 13 Lawrence had seen skylarking that morning, flung himself gallantly out onto the yard with his shirt in his hand, dripping, and smothered it out. There was no other light, nothing to show what might be going on aloft, and too much shouting and noise to hear anything of the battle above at all. Temeraire might have been roaring at full voice for all they would have known of it.
"We must get a flare-up at once," Lawrence said, taking his boots from Roland.
She had come running with them, and Morgan with his breeches.
"Calloway, go and fetch a box of flares and a flash-powder,"
Granby called. "It must be a fleur de nuit. No other breed could see without at least moonlight. If only they would stop that noise," he added, squinting uselessly up.
The loud crack warned them. Lawrence fell as Granby tried to pull him down to safety, but only a handful of splinters came flying. Screams rose from below. The bomb had gone through a weak place in the wood and down into the galley. Hot steam came up through the vent and the smell of salt pork, steeping already for the next day's dinner. Tomorrow was Thursday, Lawrence remembered. Ship's routine so deeply ingrained that the one thought followed instantly on the other in his mind.
"We must get you below,"
Granby said, taking his arm again, calling,
"Martin!"
Lawrence gave him an astonished, appalled look. Granby did not even notice, and Martin, taking his left arm, seemed to think nothing more natural.
"I am not leaving the deck," Lawrence said sharply.
The gunner Calloway came panting with the box. In a moment the whistle of the first rising flare cut through the low voices, and a yellow-white flash lit the sky. A dragon bellowed. Not Temeraire's voice, too low, and in the too short moment while the light lingered, Lawrence caught sight of Temeraire hovering protectively over the ship. The fleur de nuit had evaded him in the dark and was a little way off, twisting its head away from the light. Temeraire roared at once and darted for the French dragon, but the flare died out and fell, leaving all again black as pitch.
"Another! Another! Damn you!"
Lawrence shouted to Calloway, who was still staring aloft, just as they all were.
"He must have light! Keep them going aloft!"
More of the crewmen rushed to help him. Too many. Three more flares went up at once. and Granby sprang to keep them from any further waste. Shortly they had the time marked. One flare followed after another in steady progression, a fresh burst of light just as the previous one failed. Smoke curled around Temeraire, trailed from his wings in the thin yellow light, as he closed with a fleur-de-nuit, roaring. The French dragon dived to avoid him, and bombs scattered into the water harmlessly, the sound of the splashes travelling over the water.
"How many flares have we left?"
Lawrence asked Granby low.
4 dozen or so, no more,"
Granby said grimly. They were going very fast.
"And that is already with what the Allegiance was carrying besides our own. Their gunner brought us all they had."
Calloway slowed the rate of firing to stretch the dwindling supply longer, so that the dark returned full force between bursts of light. Their eyes were all stinging with smoke, and the strain of trying to see in the thin, always fading light of the flares. Lawrence could only imagine how Temeraire was managing, alone, half blind, against an opponent fully manned and prepared for battle.
"Sir! Captain!"
Roland cried, waving at him from the starboard rail. Martin helped Lawrence over, but before they had reached her, one of the last handful of flares went off, and for a moment the ocean behind the Allegiance was illuminated clearly. 2 French heavy frigates coming on behind them, with the wind in their favour, and 12 boats in the water crammed with men sweeping towards their either side. The lookout above had seen also.
"Sail ho! Boarders!"
he bellowed out, and all was suddenly confusion once more. Sailors running across the deck to stretch the boarding netting, and Riley at the great double wheel with his coxswain and 2 of the strongest seamen. They were putting the Allegiance about with desperate haste, trying to bring her broadside to bear. There was no sense in trying to outrun the French ships. In this wind the frigates could make a good 10 knots at least, and the Allegiance would never escape them. Ringing along the galley chimney, words and the pounding of many feet echoed up hollowly from the gun decks. Riley's midshipmen and lieutenants were already hurrying men into place at the guns, their voices high and anxious as they repeated instructions over and over, trying to drum what ought to have occupied the practice of months into the heads of men half asleep and confused.
"Calloway, save the flares!"
Lawrence said, hating to give the order. The darkness would leave Temeraire vulnerable to the fleur-de-nuit. But with so few left, they had to be conserved, until there was some better hope of being able to do real damage to the French dragon.
"Stand by to repel boarders!"
the boatswain bellowed. The Allegiance was finally coming up through the wind, and there was a moment of silence. Out in the darkness the oars kept splashing, a steady count in French drifting faintly towards them over the water, and then Riley called,
"Fire, Chabert!"
The guns below roared, red fire and smoke spitting. Impossible to tell what damage had been done, except by the mingled sounds of screaming and splintering wood to let them know at least some of the shot had gone home. On went the guns, a rolling broadside as the Allegiance made her ponderous turn. But after they had spoken once, the inexperience of the crew began to tell. At last the first gun spoke again, 4 minutes at least between shots. The second gun did not fire at all, nor the third. The 4th and 5th went together with some more audible damage, but the 6th ball could be heard splashing into clear water, also the 7th, and then Purbeck called,
"Vast firing!"
The Allegiance had carried too far. Now she could not fire again until she made her turn once more, and all the while the boarding party would be approaching, the rowers only encouraged to greater speed. The guns died away, the clouds of thick grey smoke drifted over the water, the ship was again in darkness, but for the small swaying pools of light cast off by the lanterns on deck.
"We must get you aboard Temeraire," Granby said. "We are not too far from shore yet for him to make the flight, and in any case there may be ships closer by. The transport from Halifax may be in these waters by now."
"I am not going to run away and hand 100-gun transport over to the French,"
Lawrence said, very savagely.
"I am sure we can hold out. And in any case, there is every likelihood of recapturing her before they can bring her into port, if you can warn the fleet,"
Granby argued. No naval officer would have persisted so against his commander, but aviator discipline was far more loose, and he would not be denied. It was indeed his duty as first lieutenant to see to the captain's safety.
"They could easily take her to the West Indies, or a port in Spain far from the blockades, and man her from there. We cannot lose her,"
Lawrence said.
"It would still be best to have you aboard, where they cannot lay hands on you, unless we are forced to surrender," Granby said. "We must find some way to get Temeraire clear."
"Sir," "Begging your pardon?" Calloway said, looking up from the box of flares. "If you was to get me one of those pepper guns, we might pack up a ball with flash powder and maybe give himself a bit of breathing room."
He jerked his chin up towards the sky.
"I'll speak to MacReady," Ferris said at once, and dashed away to find the ship's marine lieutenant.
The pepper gun was brought from below, two of the marines carrying the halves of the long rifled barrel up, while Calloway cautiously pried open one of the pepper balls. The gunner shook out perhaps half the pepper, and opened the locked box of flash powder, taking out a single paper twist and sealing the box again. He held the twist far out over the side, two of his mates holding his waist to keep him steady, while he unwound the twist and carefully spilled the yellow powder into the case, watching with only one eye. The other squinted up, and his face half turned away. His cheek was spotted with black scars, reminders of previous work with the powder. It needed no fuse and would go off on any careless impact, burning far hotter than gunpowder, if spent more quickly. He sealed up the ball and plunged the rest of the twist into a bucket of water. His mates threw it overboard while he smeared the seal of the ball with a little tar and covered it all over with grease before loading the gun. Then the second half of the barrel was screwed on.
"There, I don't say it will go off, but I allow as it may," Calloway said,
wiping his hands clean with no little relief.
"Very good," Lawrence said. "Stand ready and save the last three flares to give us light for the shot. MacReady, have you a man for the gun? Your best, mind you, he must strike the head to do any good." "Harris, you take her," MacReady said,
pointing one of his men to the gun, a gangly, raw-boned fellow of perhaps 18, and added to Lawrence,
"Young eyes for a long shot, sir. Never fear she'll go astray."
A low, angry rumble of voices drew their attention below, to the quarter-deck. The envoy Sun Kai had come on deck with two of the servants trailing behind, carrying one of the enormous trunks out of their luggage. The sailors and most of Temrair's crew were clustered along the rails to fend off the boarders, cutlasses and pistols in every hand. But even with the French ships gaining, one fellow with a pike went so far as to take a step towards the envoy before the boatswain started him with a knotted end of his rope, bawling,
"Keep the line, lads, keep the line!"
Lawrence had all but forgotten the disastrous dinner in the confusion. It seemed already weeks ago, but Sun Kai was still wearing the same embroidered gown, his hands folded calmly into the sleeves, and the angry, alarmed men were primed for just such a provocation.
"Oh, his soul to the devil! We must get him away! Below, sir, below at once!" he shouted, pointing at the gangway.
But Sun Kai only beckoned his men on and came climbing up to the dragon deck while they heaved the great trunk up more slowly behind him.
"Where is that damned translator?" Lawrence said. "Dyer, go and see—"
But by then the servants had hauled up the trunk. They unlocked it and flung back the lid, and there was no need for translation. The rockets that lay in the padding of straw were wildly elaborate, red and blue and green, like something out of a child's nursery, painted with swirls of colour, gold and silver, and unmistakable. Calloway snatched one at once, blue with white and yellow stripes, one of the servants anxiously miming for him how the match should be set to the fuse.
"Yes, yes," he said impatiently, bringing over the slow match.
The rocket caught at once and hissed upwards, vanishing from sight far above where the flares had gone. The white flash came first, then a great thunderclap of sound echoing back from the water, and a more faintly glimmering circle of yellow stars spread out and hung lingering in the air. The Fleur de Nuit squawked audibly, undignified, as the fireworks went off. It was revealed plainly not 100 yards above, and Temeraire immediately flung himself upwards, teeth bared, hissing furiously. Startled, the Fleur de Nuit dived, slipping under Temeraire's outstretched claws, but coming into their range.
"Harris, a shot! A shot!"
MacReady yelled, and the young marine squinted through the sight. The pepper ball flew straight and true, if a little high, but the Fleur de Nuit had narrow curving horns flaring out from its forehead just above the eyes. The ball broke open against them, and the flash powder burst white-hot and flaring. The dragon squalled again, this time in real pain, and flew wildly and fast away from the ships, deep into the dark. It swept past the ships so low that the sails shuddered noisily in the wind of its wings. Harris stood up from the gun and turned, grinning wide and gap-toothed, then fell with a look of surprise, his arm and shoulder gone. MacReady was knocked down by his falling body. Lawrence jerked a knife-long splinter out of his own arm and wiped spattered blood from his face. The pepper gun was a blasted wreck. The crew of the Fleur de Nuit had flung down another bomb even as their dragon fled and hit the gun dead on. A couple of the sailors dragged Harris's body to the side and flung him overboard. No one else had been killed. The world was queerly muffled. Calloway had sent up another pair of fireworks, a great starburst of orange streaks spreading almost over half the sky. But Lawrence could hear the explosion only in his left ear. With the Fleur de Nuit thus distracted, Temeraire dropped back down onto the deck, rocking the ship only a little.
"Harry! Harry!"
he said, ducking his head down beneath the straps as the harness men scrambled to get him rigged out.
"She is very quick, and I do not think the light hurts her as much as it did the other one, the one we fought last fall. There is something different about her eyes."
He was heaving for breath, and his wings trembled a little. He had been hovering a great deal, and it was not a manoeuvre he was accustomed to perform for any length of time. Sun Kai, who had remained upon deck, observing, did not protest the harnessing. Perhaps, Lawrence thought bitterly, they did not mind it when it was their own necks at risk. Then he noticed that drops of deep, red-black blood were dripping onto the deck.
"Where are you hurt?"
"It is not bad. She only caught me twice," Temeraire said, twisting his head around and licking at his right flank.
There was a shallow cut there, and another gouged claw mark further up on his back. Twice was a good deal more than Lawrence cared for. He snapped at Keynes, who had been sent along with them, as the man was boosted up and began to pack the wound with bandages.
"Ought you not sew them up?"
"Nonsense," Keynes said. "He'll do as he is. Barely worth calling them flesh wounds. Stop fretting."
MacReady had regained his feet, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand. He gave the surgeon a dubious look at this reply and glanced at Lawrence sidelong, the more so as Keynes continued his work muttering audibly about over-anxious captains and mother hens. Lawrence himself was too grateful to object, full of relief.
"Are you ready, gentlemen?"
he asked, checking his pistols and his sword. This time it was his good, heavy cutlass, proper Spanish steel and a plain hilt. He was glad to feel its solid weight under his hand.
"Ready for you, sir,"
Fellows said, pulling the final strap tight. Temeraire reached out and lifted Lawrence up to his shoulder.
"Give her a pull up there. Does she hold?"
he called, once Lawrence was settled and locked on again.
"Well enough,"
Lawrence called back down, having thrown his weight against the stripped-down harness.
"Thank you, Fellows. Well done. Granby, send the riflemen to the tops with the marines and the rest to repel boarders." "Very good. And Lawrence,"
Granby said, clearly meaning to once again encourage him to take Temeraire away from the battle. Lawrence cut him short by the expedient of giving Temeraire a quick nudge with his knee. The allegiance heaved again beneath the weight of his leap, and they were airborne together at last. The air above the allegiance was thick with the harsh, sulphurous smoke of the fireworks, like the smell of flintlocks, clawing on his tongue and skin despite the cold wind.
"There she is,"
Temeraire said, beating back aloft. Lawrence followed his gaze and saw the Fleur de Nuit approaching again from high above. She had indeed recovered very quickly from the blinding light, judging by his previous experience with the breed, and he wondered if perhaps she was some sort of new cross.
"Shall we go after her?"
Lawrence hesitated. For the sake of keeping Temeraire out of their hands, disabling the Fleur de Nuit was of the most urgent necessity, for if the Allegiance was forced to surrender and Temeraire had to attempt a return to shore, she could harry them in the darkness all the way back home. And yet the French frigates could do far more damage to the ship. A raking fire would mean a very slaughter of the men. If the Allegiance were taken, it would be a terrible blow to the Navy and the Corps both. They had no large transports to spare.
"No," he said finally. "Our first duty must be to preserve the Allegiance. We must do something about those frigates."
He spoke more to convince himself than Temeraire. He felt the decision was in the right, but a terrible doubt lingered. What was courage in an ordinary man might often be called recklessness in an aviator, with the responsibility for a rare and precious dragon in his hands. It was Granby's duty to be over-cautious, but it did not follow that he was in the wrong. Lawrence had not been raised in the Corps, and he knew his nature balked at many of the restraints placed upon a dragon captain. He could not help but wonder if he were consulting his own pride too far. Temeraire was always enthusiastic for battle. He made no argument, but only looked down at the frigates.
"Those ships look much smaller than the Allegiance," Temeraire said doubtfully. "Is she truly in danger?"
Very great danger. They mean to rake her.
Even as Lawrence spoke, another of the fireworks went off. The explosion came startlingly near now that he was aloft on Temeraire's back. He was forced to shield his dazzled eyes with a hand. When the spots at last faded from his eyes, he saw in alarm that the leeward frigate had suddenly club-hauled to come about, a risky manoeuvre and not one he would himself have undertaken simply for an advantage of position, though in justice he could not deny it had been brilliantly performed. Now the Allegiance had her vulnerable stern wholly exposed to the French ship's larboard guns.
"Good God! There!"
he said urgently, pointing even though Temeraire could not see the gesture.
"I see her,"
Temeraire said, already diving. His sides were swelling out with the gathering breath required for the divine wind, the gleaming black hide going drum-hide taut as his deep chest expanded. Lawrence could feel a palpable, low, rumbling echo already building beneath Temeraire's skin, a herald of the destructive power to come. The fleur-de-nuit had made out his intentions. She was coming on behind them. He could hear her wings beating, but Temeraire was the faster, his greater weight not hampering him in the dive.
Gunpowder cracked noisily as her riflemen took shots, but their attempts were only guesswork in the dark.
Lawrence laid himself close to Temeraire's neck and silently willed him to greater speed. Below them, the frigate's cannon erupted in a great cloud of smoke and fury. Flames licked out from the ports and flung an appalling scarlet glow up against Temeraire's breast. A fresh cracking of rifle fire came from the frigate's decks, and he jerked, sharply, as if struck. Lawrence called out his name in anxiety, but Temeraire had not paused in his drive towards the ship. He levelled out to blast her, and the sound of Lawrence's voice was lost in the terrible thundering noise of the divine wind. Temeraire had never before used the divine wind to attack a ship, but in the Battle of Dover, Lawrence had seen the deadly resonance work against Napoleon's troop carriers, shattering their light wood. He had expected something similar here, the deck splintering, damage to the yards, perhaps even breaking the masts. But the French frigate was solidly built, with oak planking as much as 2 feet thick, and her masts and yards were well secured for battle, with iron chains to reinforce the rigging. Instead, the sails caught and held the force of Temeraire's roar. They shivered for a moment, then bulged out full and straining. A score of braces snapped like violin strings, the masts all leaning away. Yet still they held, wood and sailcloth groaning, and for a moment Lawrence's heart sank. No great damage, it seemed, would be done. But if part would not yield, then all must perforce bend. Even as Temeraire stopped his roaring and went flashing by, the whole ship turned away, driven broadside to the wind, and slowly toppled over onto her side. The tremendous force left her all but on her beam ends, men hanging loose from the rigging and the rails, their feet kicking in mid-air, some falling into the ocean. Lawrence twisted about to look back towards her as they swept on, Temeraire skimming past, low to the water. Valérie was emblazoned in lovingly bright gold letters upon her stern, illuminated by lanterns hung in the cabin windows, now swinging crazily, half overturned. Her captain knew his work. Lawrence could hear shouts carrying across the water, and already the men were crawling up onto the side with every sort of sea anchor in their hands, hawsers run out, ready to try to right her. But they had no time. In Temeraire's wake, churned up by the force of the divine wind upon the water, a tremendous wave was climbing out of the swell. Slow and high it mounted, as if with some deliberate intent. For a moment all hung still, the ship suspended in blackness, the great shining wall of water blotting out even the night. Then, falling, the wave heeled her over like a child's toy, and the ocean quenched all the fire of her guns. She did not come up again. A pale froth lingered, and a scattered few smaller waves chased the great one and broke upon the curve of the hull, which remained above the surface. A moment only, then it slipped down beneath the waters, and a hail of golden fireworks lit the sky. The fleur-de-nuit circled low over the churning waters, belling out in her deep, lonely voice, as though unable to understand the sudden absence of the ship. There was no sound of cheering from the Allegiance. though they must have seen. Lawrence himself was silent, dismayed. 300 men, perhaps more, the ocean smooth and glassy, unbroken. A ship might founder in a gale, in high winds and 40-foot waves. A ship might occasionally be sunk in an action, burnt or exploded after a long battle, run aground on rocks. But she had been untouched, in open ocean with no more than a 10-foot swell and winds of 14 knots, and now obliterated whole. Temeraire coughed wetly and made a sound of pain. Lawrence hoarsely called, "Back to the ship! At once!" But already the Fleur de Nuit was beating furiously towards them. Against the next brilliant flare he could see the silhouettes of the boarders waiting, ready to leap aboard, knives and swords and pistols glittering white along their edges. Temeraire was flying so very awkwardly, laboured. As the Fleur de Nuit came close, he put on a desperate effort and lunged away, but he was no longer quicker in the air, and he could not get around the other dragon to reach the safety of the Allegiance. Lawrence might almost have let them come aboard, to treat the wound. He could feel the quivering labour of Temeraire's wings, and his mind was full of that scarlet moment, the terrible muffled impact of the ball.
Every moment aloft now might worsen the injury.
But he could hear the shouting voices of the French dragon's crew, full of a grief and horror that required no translation, and he did not think they would accept a surrender.
"I hear wings!"
Temeraire gasped, voice gone high and thin with pain, meaning another dragon, and Lawrence vainly searched the impenetrable night, British or French. The Fleur de Nuit abruptly darted at them again. Temeraire gathered himself for another convulsive burst of speed, and then, hissing and spitting, Nitidus was there, beating about the head of the French dragon in a flurry of silver-grey wings. Captain Warren on his back, standing in harness and waving his hat wildly at Lawrence, yelling, "Go! Go!" Dulcia had come about them on the other side, nipping at the Fleur de Nuit's flanks, forcing the French dragon to double back and snap at her. The two light dragons were the quickest of their formation mates, and though not up to the weight of the big Fleur de Nuit, they might harry her a little while. Temeraire was already turning in a slow arc, his wings working in shuddering sweeps. As they closed with the ship, Lawrence could see the crew scrambling to clear the dragon deck for him to land. It was littered with splinters and ends of rope, twisted metal. The Allegiance had suffered badly from the raking, and the second frigate was keeping up a steady fire on her lower decks. Temeraire did not properly land, but half fell clumsily onto the deck and set the whole ship to rocking. Lawrence was casting off his straps before they were even properly down. He slid down behind the withers without a hand on the harness. His leg gave way beneath him as he came down heavily upon the deck, but he only dragged himself up again and staggered, half falling, to Temeraire's head. Keynes was already at work, elbow-deep in black blood. To better give him access, Temeraire was leaning slowly over onto his side under the guidance of many hands, the harness men holding up the light for the surgeon. Lawrence went to his knees by Temeraire's head and pressed his cheek to the soft muzzle. Blood soaked warm through his trousers, and his eyes were stinging, blurred. He did not quite know what he was saying, nor whether it made any sense, but Temeraire blew out warm air against him in answer, though he did not speak.
"There, I have it. Now the tongs! Alan, stop that foolishness or put your head over the side,"
Keynes said, somewhere behind his back.
"Good. Is the iron hot? Now then, Lawrence, he must be kept steady."
"Hold fast, dear heart," Lawrence said, stroking Temeraire's nose. "Hold as still as ever you may. Hold still."
Temeraire gave a hiss only, and his breath wheezed in loudly through his red, flaring nostrils. One heartbeat, two, then the breath burst out of him, and the spiked ball rang as Keynes dropped it into the waiting tray. Temeraire gave another small hissing cry as the hot iron was clapped to the wound. Lawrence nearly heaved at the scorched, roasting smell of meat.
"There, it is over. A clean wound. The ball had fetched up against the breastbone,"
Keynes said. The wind blew the smoke clear, and suddenly Lawrence could hear the crash and echo of the long guns again, and all the noise of the ship. The world once again had meaning and shape. Lawrence dragged himself up to his feet, swaying.
"Roland," he said, "you and Morgan run and see what odds and ends of sailcloth and wadding they may have to spare.
We must try and put some padding around him.
Morgan is dead, sir, Roland said,
and in the lantern light he saw abruptly that her face was tracked with tears, not sweat. Pale streaks through grime.
Dyer and I will go.
The two of them did not wait for him to nod, but darted away at once, shockingly small in and among the burly forms of the sailors. He followed after them with his eyes for a moment and turned back, his face hardening. The quarter-deck was so thickly slimed with blood that portions shone glossy black as though freshly painted. By the slaughter and lack of destruction in the rigging, Lawrence thought the French must have been using canister shot, and indeed he could see some parts of the broken casings lying about on the deck. The French had crammed every man who could be spared into the boats, and there were a great many of those. 200 desperate men were struggling to come aboard, enraged with the loss of their ship. They were 4 and 5 deep along the grappling lines in places, or clinging to the rails, and the British sailors trying to hold them back had all the broad and empty deck behind them. Pistol shot rang clear, and the clash of swords. Sailors with long pikes were jabbing into the mass of boarders as they heaved and pushed. Lawrence had never seen a boarding fight from such a strange in-between distance, at once near and yet removed. He felt very queer and unsettled, and drew his pistols out for comfort. He could not see many of his crew, Granby missing, and Evans, his second lieutenant, too. Down on the forecastle below, Martin's yellow hair shone bright in the lanterns for a moment as he leapt to cut a man off. Then he disappeared under a blow from a big French sailor carrying a club.
"Lawrence!"
he heard his name, or at least something like it, strangely drawn out into 3 syllables, and turned to look. Song Kai was pointing northward along the line of the wind, but the last burst of fireworks was already fading, and Lawrence could not see what he meant to point out. Above, the fleur-de-nuit suddenly gave a roar. She banked sharply away from Nitidus and Dulcia, who were still darting at her flanks, and set off due eastward, flying fast, vanishing very quickly into the darkness. Almost on her heels came the deep belly roar of a regal copper, and the higher shrieks of yellow reapers. The wind of their passage set all the shrouds snapping back and forth as they swept overhead, firing flares off in every direction. The remaining French frigate doused her lights all at once, hoping to escape into the night, but Lily led the formation past her, low enough to rattle her masts. 2 passes, and in a fading crimson starburst, Lawrence saw the French colours slowly come drooping down, while all across the deck the boarders flung down their weapons and sank to the deck in surrender.
Chapter 5.
And the conduct of your son was in all ways both heroic and gentlemanly. His loss must grieve all those who shared in the privilege of his acquaintance, and none more so than those honoured to serve alongside him, and to see in him already formed the noble character of a wise and courageous officer and a loyal servant of his country and king. I pray that you may find some comfort in the sure knowledge that he died as he would have lived, valiant, fearing nothing but Almighty God, and certain to find a place of honour among those who have sacrificed all for their nation. Yours, etc., William Lawrence. He laid the pen down and folded over the letter. It was miserably awkward, inadequate, and yet he could do no better. He had lost friends near his own age enough as a mid and a young lieutenant, and 1 13-year-old boy under his own first command. Even so, he had never before had to write a letter for a 10-year-old, who by rights ought still to have been in his schoolroom playing with tin soldiers. It was the last of the obligatory letters, and the thinnest. There had not been very much to say of earlier acts of valour. Lawrence set it aside and wrote a few lines of a more personal nature, these to his mother. News of the engagement would certainly be published in the Gazette, and he knew she would be anxious. It was difficult to write easily after the earlier task. He confined himself to assuring her of his health and Temeraire's, dismissing their collective injuries as inconsequential. He had written a long and grinding description of the battle in his report for the Admiralty. He did not have the heart to paint a lighter picture of it for her eyes. Having done at last, he shut up his small writing desk and collected the letters, each one sealed and wrapped in oilcloth against rain or seawater. He did not get up right away, but sat looking out the windows at the empty ocean in silence.
Making his way back up to the dragon deck was a slow affair of easy stages. Having gained the forecastle, he limped for a moment to the larboard rail to rest, pretending it was to look over at their prize, the Chanteuse. Her sails were all hung out loose and billowing. Men were clambering over her masts, getting her rigging back into order, looking much like busy ants at this distance. The scene upon the dragon deck was very different now, with nearly all the formation crammed aboard. Temeraire had been allotted the entire starboard section, the better to ease his wound, but the rest of the dragons lay in a complicated, many-coloured heap of entangled limbs, stirring rarely. Maximus alone took up virtually all the space remaining and lay on the bottom. Even Lily, who ordinarily considered it beneath her dignity to curl up with other dragons, was forced to let her tail and wing drape over him, while Masoria and Immortalis, older dragons and smaller, made not even such pretensions, and simply sprawled upon his great back, a limb dangling loose here and there. They were all drowsing and looked perfectly happy with their circumstances. Nitidus only was too fidgety to like lying still very long, and he was presently aloft, circling the frigate curiously. A little too low for the comfort of the sailors, judging by the nervous way heads on the Chanteuse often turned skyward. Dulcia was nowhere in sight, perhaps already gone to carry news of the engagement back to England. Crossing the deck had become something of an adventure, particularly with his uncooperative and dragging leg. Lawrence only narrowly managed to avoid falling over Masoria's hanging tail when she twitched in her sleep. Temeraire was soundly asleep as well. When Lawrence came to look at him, one eye slid halfway open, gleamed at him deep blue, and slid at once closed again. Lawrence did not try to rouse him, very glad to see him comfortable. Temeraire had eaten well that morning, two cows and a large tunny, and Keynes had pronounced himself satisfied with the present progress of the wound. "A nasty sort of weapon," he had said, taking a ghoulish pleasure in showing Lawrence the extracted ball. Staring unhappily at its many squat spikes, Lawrence could only be grateful it had been cleaned before he had been obliged to look at it. "I have not seen its like before, though I hear the Russians use something of the sort. I should not have enjoyed working it out if it had gone any deeper, I can tell you." By good fortune, the ball had come up against the breastbone, and lodged scarcely half a foot beneath the skin. Even so, the ball itself and the extraction had torn the muscles of the breast cruelly, and Keynes said Temeraire ought not to fly at all for as long as 2 weeks, perhaps even a month. Lawrence rested a hand upon the broad, warm shoulder. He was glad to have only so much of a price to pay. The other captains were sitting at a small folding table wedged up against the galley chimney, very nearly the only open space available on the deck, playing cards. Lawrence joined them and gave Harcourt the bundle of letters.
"Thank you for taking them," he said, sitting down heavily to catch his breath.
They all paused in the game to look at the large packet.
"I am so very sorry, Lawrence."
Harcourt put the whole into her satchel.
"You have been wretchedly mauled about."
"Damned cowardly business," Berkeley shook his head. "More like spying than proper combat, this skulking about at night."
Lawrence was silent. He was grateful for their sympathy, but at present he was too much oppressed to manage conversation. The funerals had been ordeal enough, keeping his feet for an hour against his legs' complaints, while one after another the bodies were slipped over the side, sewn into their hammocks with round shot at their feet for the sailors, iron shells for the aviators, as Riley read slowly through the service. He had spent the remainder of the morning closeted with Lieutenant Ferris, now his acting second, telling over the butcher's bill, a sadly long list. Granby had taken a musket ball in his chest. Thankfully it had cracked against the rib and gone straight out again in back, but he had lost a great deal of blood and was already feverish. Evans, his second lieutenant, had a badly broken leg and was to be sent back to England. Martin, at least, would recover, but his jaw was presently so swollen he could not speak except in mumbles, and he could not yet see out of his left eye. Two more of the topmen wounded, less severely, one of the riflemen, Dunn, wounded, and another, Donnell, killed. Migsy of the bellmen killed, and worst hit, the harness men. Four of them had been killed by a single cannonball which had caught them below decks while they had been carrying away the extra harness. Morgan had been with them, carrying the box of spare buckles. A wretched waste. Perhaps seeing something of the tally in his face, Berkeley said,
"At least I can leave you Portis and McDonough," referring to two of Lawrence's top men, who had been transferred to Maximus during the confusion after the envoy's arrival. "Are you not short-handed yourself?" Lawrence asked. "I cannot rob Maximus. You will be on active duty." "The transport coming from Halifax, the William of Orange, has a dozen likely fellows for Maximus," Berkeley said. "No reason you cannot have your own back again." "I ought not argue with you. Heaven knows I am desperately short," Lawrence said. "But the transport may not arrive for a month, if her crossing has been slow."
"Oh, you were below earlier, so you did not hear us tell Captain Riley," Warren said. "William was sighted only a few days ago, not far from here. So we have sent Chennery and Dulcia off to fetch her, and she will take us and the wounded home. Also, I believe Riley was saying that this boat needs something. It could not have been stars, Berkeley?"
"Spars,"
Lawrence said, looking up at the rigging. In the daylight he could see that the yards which supported the sails did indeed look very ugly, much splintered and pockmarked with bullets.
"It will certainly be a relief if she can spare us some supplies. But you must know, Warren, this is a ship, not a boat."
"Is there a difference?"
Warren was unconcerned, scandalizing Lawrence.
"I thought they were simply two words for the same thing. Or is it a matter of size? This is certainly a behemoth, although Maximus is like to fall off her deck at any moment."
"I am not,"
Maximus said. But he opened his eyes and peered over at his hind quarters, only settling back to sleep when he had satisfied himself that he was not in present danger of tipping into the water. Lawrence opened his mouth and closed it again without venturing on an explanation. He felt the battle was already lost.
"You will be with us for a few days, then?"
"Until tomorrow only," Harcourt said. "If it looks to be longer than that, I think we must take the flight. I do not like to strain the dragons without need, but I like leaving Lenton short at Dover still less, and he will be wondering where on earth we have got to. We were only meant to be doing night manoeuvres with the fleet off Brest when we saw you all firing off like Guy Fawkes Day."
Riley had asked them all to dinner, of course, and the captured French officers as well. Harcourt was obliged to plead seasickness as an excuse for avoiding the close quarters, where her gender might too easily be revealed, and Berkeley was a taciturn fellow, disinclined to speak in sentences of more than 5 words at a time. But Warren was both free and easy in his speech, the more so after a glass or two of strong wine, and Sutton had a fine store of anecdotes, having been in service nearly 30 years. Together they carried the conversation along in an energetic, if somewhat ramshackle, way. But the Frenchmen were silent and shocked, and the British sailors only a little less so. Their oppression only grew more apparent over the course of the meal. Lord Purbeck was stiff and formal, Macready grim. Even Riley was quiet, inclined to uncharacteristic and long periods of silence, and plainly uncomfortable. On the dragon deck afterwards, over coffee, Warren said,
"Lawrence, I do not mean to insult your old service or your shipmates, but, Lord, they make it heavy going."
"Tonight I should have thought we had offended them mortally, not saved them a good long fight, and whoever knows how many buckets full of blood."
"I expect they feel we came rather late to save them very much."
Sutton leaned against his dragon Massoria companionably and lit a cigar.
"So instead we have robbed them of the full glory, not to mention that we have a share in the prize, you know, having arrived before the French ship struck. Would you care for a draught, my dear?" he asked,
holding the cigar where Massoria could breathe the smoke.
"No, you have mistaken them entirely, I assure you," Lawrence said. "We should never have taken the frigate if you had not come. She was not so badly mauled, she could not have shown us her heels whenever she chose. Every man aboard was wholly glad to see you come."
He did not very much wish to explain, but he did not like to leave them with so ill an impression, so he added briefly,
"It is the other frigate, the Valerie, which we sank before you came. The loss of men was very great."
They perceived his own disquiet and pressed him no further. When Warren made as if to ask, Sutton nudged him into silence and called his runner for a deck of cards. They settled to a casual game of speculation, Harcourt having joined them now that they had parted from the naval officers. Lawrence finished his cup and slipped quietly away. Temeraire was himself sitting and looking out across the empty sea. He had slept all the day and roused just lately for another large meal. He shifted himself to make a place for Lawrence upon his foreleg and curled about him with a small sigh.
"Do not take it to heart."
Lawrence was aware he was giving advice he could not himself follow, but he feared that Temeraire might brood on the sinking too long, and drive himself into a melancholy.
With the second frigate on our larboard, we should likely have been brought by the lee, and had they doused all the lights and stopped our fireworks, Lily and the others could hardly have found us in the night.
You saved many lives, and the Allegiance herself.
I do not feel guilty, Temeraire said. I did not intend to sink her, but I am not sorry for that. They meant to kill a great many of my crew, and of course I would not let them. It is the sailors. They look at me so queerly now, and they do not like to come near at all.
Lawrence could neither deny the truth of this observation nor offer any false comfort. Sailors preferred to see a dragon as a fighting machine, very much like a ship, which happened to breathe and fly, a mere instrument of man's will. They could accept without great difficulty his strength and brute force, natural as a reflection of his size. If they feared him for it, so might a large, dangerous man be feared. The divine wind, however, bore an unearthly tinge, and the wreck of the Valerie was too implacable to be human. It woke every wild old legend of fire and destruction from the sky. Already the battle seemed very like a nightmare in his own memory. The endless, gaudy stream of the fireworks and the red light of the cannon firing, the ash-white eyes of the Fleur de Nuit in the dark, bitter smoke on his tongue, and above all the slow descent of the wave, like a curtain lowering upon a play. He stroked Temeraire's arm in silence, and together they watched the wake of the ship slipping gently by. The cry of "Sail!" came at the first dim light. The William of Orange clear on the horizon, 2 points off the starboard bow. Riley squinted through his glass.
"We will pipe the hands to breakfast early. She will be in hailing distance well before 9.
The Chanteuse lay between the two larger ships and was already hailing the oncoming transport. She herself would be going back to England to be condemned as a prize, carrying the prisoners. The day was clear and very cold, the sky that peculiarly rich shade of blue reserved for winter, and the Chanteuse looked cheerful with her white t'gallants and royals set. It being rare for a transport to take a prize, the mood ought to have been celebratory. A handsome 44-gun ship and a trim sailor, she would certainly be brought into the service, and there would be head money for the prisoners besides. But the unsettled mood had not quite cleared overnight, and the men were mostly quiet as they worked. Lawrence himself had not slept very well, and now he stood on the forecastle watching the William of Orange draw near, wistfully. Soon they would once again be quite alone.
"Good morning, Captain," Hammond said, joining him at the rail.
The intrusion was unwelcome, and Lawrence did not make much attempt to hide it, but this made no immediate impression. Hammond was too busy gazing upon the Chanteuse, an indecent satisfaction showing on his face.
"We could not have asked for a better start to the journey."
Several of the crew were at work nearby repairing the shattered deck, the carpenter and his mates. One of them, a cheerful, slant-shouldered fellow named Leddows, brought aboard at Spithead and already established as the ship's jester, sat up on his heels at this remark and stared at Hammond in open disapproval, until the carpenter, Eklof, a big, silent Swede, thumped him on the shoulder with his big fist, drawing him back down to the work.
"I am surprised you think so," Lawrence said. "Would you not have preferred a first-rate?"
"No, no," Hammond said, oblivious to sarcasm. "It is just as one could wish. Do you know one of the balls passed quite through the prince's cabin? One of his guards was killed, and another, badly wounded, passed away during the night. I understand he's in a towering rage. The French Navy has done us more good in one night than months of diplomacy. Do you suppose the captain of the captured ship might be presented to him? Of course, I have told them our attackers were French, but it would be as well to give them incontrovertible proof."
"We are not going to march a defeated officer about like a prize in some Roman triumph," Lawrence said levelly. He had been made prisoner once himself, and though he had been scarcely a boy at the time, a young midshipman, he still remembered the perfect courtesy of the French captain, asking him quite seriously for his parole.
"Of course, I do see. It would not look very well, I suppose," Hammond said,
but only as a regretful concession, and he added,
"although it would be a pity if—"
"Is that all?"
Lawrence interrupted him, unwilling to hear any more.
"Oh, I beg your pardon. Forgive my having intruded,"
Hammond said uncertainly, finally looking at Lawrence.
"I meant only to inform you the Prince has expressed a desire of seeing you."
"Thank you, sir," Lawrence said with finality.
Hammond looked as though he would have liked to say something more, perhaps to urge Lawrence to go at once, or give him some advice for the meeting, but in the end he did not dare, and with a short bow went abruptly away.